Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Lynn Peters. I am Colorado Attorney Registration Number 31699. I am here today on behalf of my clients, Lanny and Karen Harsh, who were involved in a sales transaction with the Republican River Water Conservation District, which for shortness, I will just simply call the district and assume we can all know who I'm talking about. The Harshes were the plaintiffs in the underlying case and are the appellants here. In January of 2008, they entered into a contract to sell several acres of their farm to the district in exchange for a certain sum of money. As part of that contract, there was $75,000 placed in earnest money with the Yuma County Abstract Company, the closing agent. And closing was set specifically in the contract for August 15th of 2008. Those facts are really not disputed. Neither is the fact that the closing did not occur. The main issue in this case, as it was in the trial court, is why the closing did not occur. The contract has a very specific provision that if the contract was breached, in other words, if the reason for the closing was the district's failure and not the Harshes, the Harshes are entitled to that earnest money. That's their sole and only remedy for a breach by the district. I submit to you today what occurred and what's clear from the facts is that it was the district that could not close and was not ready on August 15th and not the Harshes. And it occurred to me as I was reviewing all of the materials for today that really what this court is being asked to decide is whether or not a request to continue a trial date to, or excuse me, continue a closing date to an earlier date. Just the mere question can be an anticipatory repudiation of a contract, because that's what the trial court held here. The trial court found that the Harshes committed a prior breach of contract before the district because they asked to move the closing up.
Pardon me for interrupting Ms. Peters, if I may, please, but didn't the court find more than that? Didn't the court also find that the reason for this is that the Harsh's attorney at the time could not attend the closing on the 15th of August?
Well, the court did tie into emails that referenced whether or not the Harsh's attorney could be present, but those emails were sent by a third party and not by the Harsh's attorney herself.
I understand what you're saying here, but at least as far as these historical facts are concerned, aren't we, once the court finds them, isn't our review limited to determining whether the court committed clear error in making those findings?
I believe that's true with regard to the findings of fact. I struggle with here where the facts weren't really in dispute, where the facts are pretty clear and the emails speak for themselves, and what we really have here is a trial court who, in our opinion, misapplied the law, understood what it took to have a repudiation of contract, and yet tortured that to apply it to a set of facts that doesn't fit it. Is that really something that should be given deference by this court? I find that as an error of law in and of itself. And so that's why I struggle with, is this just really a clearly erroneous standard?
So you say the facts are uncontested. You do not dispute that the prior attorney was unable to attend the August 15 closing?
We do not.
Okay.
And we did not dispute that at trial. I believe the testimony at trial was, from all concerned, that Ms. Wagers Johnson, the week before this closing, said, hey, wait a minute, I'm not sure I can be there, so if I'm going to be at that closing, I'd like to move it up. Nowhere did she say, or at no time in the Harshes say, that if she's not at closing, this closing won't happen, or that we can't close without our attorney present.
But we also have a problem, don't we, counsel, that in the emails that were sent by the closing agent, that message was conveyed to the district, and the trial court made a finding that the emails from the closing agent accurately reflected the information that was given to the closing agent by the seller's attorney.
Let me take that in two parts. First, the trial court's finding that he found it was consistent with what was being told is not based on any testimony or anything else that came in at trial, and in that sense is unsupported by the evidence.
So you contest that finding itself. That's not in your briefs, counsel, and I don't recall seeing it in your briefs.
to be honest with you, I can't recall if we made that specific of an allegation in our briefs. But
nevertheless, isn't that an inference that could have been drawn by the trial court from the testimony that was given? And aren't we supposed to give deference to that inference?
I don't think he drew it from the testimony, though. I think what's clear from the trial court's ruling is that he drew an inference from the email communications. And the emails, even the emails he relied on that you're referring to, from Ms. Leona Olson, the closing agent, to Mr. Montgomery, the counsel for the district, said the Harshes have requested that their attorney be at closing. She's not available. So is it possible to do it earlier? Nowhere do they say we can't close without her. And everybody, and there was a lot of discussion at trial about all the possible other options that could have happened if the district had said, you know what, we need this closing on the 15th. They could have accommodated.
They didn't say they could not close without her, but it's a reasonable inference, isn't it, that they would not close without her?
I disagree. I think the fact that they were asking to move it up to try to accommodate her schedule it does not lead necessarily to the conclusion that, or the only conclusion, as the trial court found, that they wouldn't have closed without her.
But when we're talking about inferences, isn't the active word reasonable? And don't we have to look at whether this inference is reasonably drawn, not certainly drawn?
I believe that's true. And I would contend it's not a reasonable inference.
Okay.
And based on the totality of all the emails, and all of the information that went back and forth, I think this court will find it's not a reasonable inference. The point here is, if you just took that first communication, that first set of, can we close sooner? We'd like our attorney at closing. She's not available on this date we set. Can we close sooner? If that alone was the only communication sent, would that be enough for the district to say the Harshes are in breach? That's what you have to find here. I think that has to be the conclusion of law that gets reached based on that fact alone in order to uphold the trial court's ruling. And I think that's absurd. There's no court that's going to look at that kind of an email saying, can we move it up, and give the other party a way out of a contract based on that alone. And that's really what that's really what the issue is here today. Is that enough to be a breach of contract? The unfortunate thing about this case is that what happened in response was not a, I'm not available, let's reschedule, no, I have to have it on the 15th. It was, the district can't close, we don't have the money. And so what we have in response to a reasonable request to move the closing up is, irrespective of what was going on with the Harshes, the district said, we can't close, we don't have the money.
Did the trial court find that?
Yes.
That the district did not have the money?
Testimony at trial was that the district had the money.
That wasn't my, yeah. My.
The trial court found the district was not ready to close. The trial court found specifically the district conveyed to the Harshes. They thought there was a contingency in the contract, and so they didn't have the loan and were not ready to close. Which brings me to the vast and, in my opinion, direct contradictions that appear in this trial court's order. The trial court finds the Harshes were ready and prepared to close. There was nothing standing in the way of their closing. They found the district was not ready to close. Trial court's finding, clear as day, district is not ready to close. And then finds, at the very end, that neither party was ready. There were too many loose ends, and there was a mutual anticipatory breach of contract that the Harshes went first.
If the communications that were sent were found, I understand you're disputing that they're the finding that it was a repudiation on the part of the Harshes, but if they're found to be a repudiation on the date they were sent, why does it matter whether the Harshes were ready to show up on the 15th or not? In other words, the repudiation would have come first, and it doesn't matter what happens after that. Can please address that.
And I think to the extent the court found that the district repudiated the contract by saying we're not ready to close, that's why it doesn't matter that no deeds were prepared, that nobody physically showed up for closing, because there was a clear repudiation in this case, but it was on behalf of the district, not the Harshes.
So why does it matter then that the Harshes were prepared to close?
Well, it matters because the court says in one sentence the Harshes were prepared to close, And then on the last page says, but I find the Harsh is in breach of contract. Because they weren't.
I'm trying to figure out what relevancy the Harsh is being prepared to close has at all as to whether this document was a repudiation of the contract.
I think it goes to the contradictedness of these findings. If the Harsh is in that email saying, I can't close without my attorney, if that's the interpretation you give that email, then the Harshes aren't ready to close. They can't be. Their attorney's not available. So we have this inconsistency in the court's drawing of that inference.
I can be ready to close, but unwilling to do so without their attorney present. So I don't see in that situation how those are necessarily inconsistent.
Well, I think that's true. If there was a finding, they were unwilling to close without their attorney. And I don't think that there's a finding to that effect in the trial court's ruling. And the trial court said it was he inferred that what Fiona Olson said, they'd like their attorney at closing and she's not available. That's not we're unwilling to close without our attorney. I think that's reading far more equivocation and far more certainty into what the Harshes would or wouldn't have done into an email sent by a third party, not by an agent of the Harshes. And that's our other issue here with this finding of repudiation on the part of the Harshes. The court is attributing a breach to the Harshes based on comments and communications made by a third party the court specifically found was not the Harshes' agent. And that seems to fly directly in the face of the comments and the illustrations that are cited in our brief to the restatement of contracts. A tells B, I don't think I'm going to close, I can't close. B tells C the same thing. Restatement says that's still not a repudiation because it didn't come from A. And that's the situation we have here. There's no direct communication between the Harshes or their attorney, their agent, to the district that they won't close without their attorney.
What do we do about the email? What do we do about the email from the closing agent saying I conveyed your message to the sellers and told them that you wanted to close later? She knows it's being conveyed.
Yes, but what the email from...
Why am I to infer that it was unauthorized?
Well, the email from Ms. Wagers-Johnson was, if I'm to be at closing, I'd like it to be earlier.
But that's not the only communication the parties had. The court found they had telephonic communications also.
Well, I guess I don't recall that particular findings in the trial court's ruling. I guess,
and there was testimony that they had telephonic communications.
There were, but they were all, as Ms. Wagers-Johnson testified to, they were all, if I'm going to be there, we should do it sooner. You'll notice in some of the exhibits, there were also communications with the 1031 exchange agent and the closing agent where there were discussions about Ms. Wagers-Johnson having her client sign early, but the closing still taking place on the 15th.
What's the difference between, let's say that the closing agent is a telegraph operator, and you say, convey this message to these other people, okay? And it's just basically she's a telegraph operator giving a message from A to B, and as long as the message goes through correctly, why do I have to worry about whether the telegraph operator is an agent of the sellers or not?
I think in that scenario, you don't.
Why is this different?
In this scenario, I think based on the testimony given at trial, the communication got changed from point A to point B.
We would have to say that the finding of the trial court to the contrary is clearly erroneous.
And I think based on the testimony, you can do that. And I also think based on what came in at trial and the testimony.
But Ms. Wagers-Johnson didn't say that it got communicated incorrectly. There's no testimony to say it was incorrect.
Ms. Wagers-Johnson was adamant at trial. She did not convey to anybody that she had to be at closing in order for it to occur or that the Harshes would not close without her. There was no testimony contrary to that either. And so for the court to draw an inference from the email and assume they would not have closed without their lawyer.
Do you have a record cite to that for me, counsel?
Unfortunately, I do not have the record in front of me today.
Okay.
I could certainly be happy to supplement if the court would like.
I would like. Okay. Thank you.
I see I'm at 40 seconds, so rather than start my next point, I think I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Do.
And answer any other questions you have at that time.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Hunt with Hill and Robbins, and my attorney number is 29964. And I am appearing today on behalf of the Appellee Republican River Water Conservation District Water Activity Enterprise. I will refer to them again as the district for simplicity. Before I begin my remarks, I want to start by circling back around to a couple of the questions that Your Honors just asked, in particular address the issue of whether the facts were in dispute. And I think that the answer didn't come out perhaps clearly, that the facts, most of the facts correctly, were not in dispute. But whether the Harshes were prepared to close without their attorney was in dispute. And I think that, again, going back and looking over everything, that ended up being the key dispute of fact. And whether they could go to closing without their attorney was determined by the court in the negative. No. He determined, based on the testimony that he heard and the evidence he saw, that the Harshes were not prepared to go to closing without their attorney.
What evidence supported that specifically? In the emails, it looks like they were asking, clearly they desired their attorney to be there, but it looked like they were requesting whether it was possible to move it to an earlier date. But where, either in the emails or the testimony, was it, could it be inferred that instead of just being a desire, that this was going to cut the deal off, that it would prohibit the closing?
I believe that it was decided in the order of the court that it was, that the testimony that they could, of Mr. Harsh, that he was prepared to go to closing without his lawyer, he did not find to be credible. And that the fact that the attorney testified that in order to do that, the documents would have had to have been prepared ahead of time so she could go over them with her client, but that wasn't done.
But I guess I'm asking whether or not Mr. Harsh was or was not prepared to go. I'm wondering what was conveyed to the district to let them know that they needed the attorney there or the closing was going to be off.
Well, I don't think it was prepared that it was ever communicated that the entire closing would be off. What was communicated was, and this is in the emails, that the attorney for the sellers, the Harshes, was not available to close and they wanted her there. And so the closing date would have to be moved.
Well, where is the would have to be? That's what I'm wondering. I didn't see that in the emails.
I'm sorry. I believe that's in one of the emails from Ms. Olson, the original email from Ms. Olson, the closing agent, to the attorney for the district, saying that they wanted, the Harsh's attorney was not available on the 15th. It would have to be moved because they wanted her there. So, and I want to say that, acknowledge the question of Judge Terry about inferences, and that's exactly right, that the trial court did draw in inferences from the evidence that I just recited, that they would not close without their attorney. And this is based on the testimony and the record. Now, what we just heard from counsel and what comes through in their briefs very clearly is that they would like this court to apply the law to the facts as they see them, not as the trial court found them. We had a trial, the judge heard the evidence, heard the testimony, and made factual findings based on his assessment of the credibility of the witnesses. In the trial court, and just a moment ago, the Harshes suggested that the district was not financially able to close, or otherwise was looking for a way out. This was not borne out by the evidence. And I want to be clear on this, that the evidence at trial was that the district had the money and intended to close this deal. A fair reading of the evidence in trial is that it was the Harshes who decided they wanted a way out. And the failure to close on the date stated in the contract provided a convenient technical argument by which they thought they could keep their property and their earnest money from the district. But as the trial court rightly found, if the Harshes want to insist on strict enforcement of the closing date provision, the contract must also be strictly applied to them. They cannot have it both ways. The contract required the seller to deliver a deed at closing. And the fact that they cannot turn around and argue that whether they could have delivered a deed on August 15th was irrelevant because everyone knew the district would do it. Delivery of the deed and delivery of the purchase price were concurrent obligations to happen at closing. Ultimately, the trial court determined that the Harshes were not prepared to close on the date stated in the contract. And I want to acknowledge a question earlier about being prepared to close. The findings of the court are not at odds here. The district, or the court, found that the Harshes were prepared to close as a personal matter. They were willing to close the deal. There weren't any conditions precedent that they had to meet. But what he determined was they were not prepared to close on that day without their counsel. They hadn't prepared a deed.
Counsel, let me ask you the similar question to what I asked your colleague, and that is, does it matter whether it, who was prepared to close? If this document that was sent, these set of documents that were sent to the district were a repudiation, does it matter any of the testimony about who was prepared to close and who wasn't prepared to close?
No, I don't believe so. The communication, if the communication is a repudiation, that's done. I think this might be getting at the reliance argument they make in their brief. Reliance doesn't come into play until someone tries to retract a repudiation, and that was never done.
I realize I'm taking this out of order, but I am looking at the emails that were sent by Ms. Olson, and I'm not seeing words that are as certain as what you've conveyed, that they would not close. They're asking if it's possible to close on another date.
I believe, again, that the inferences can be made that when sent to the attorney saying, we need to change this date, and she's not available, and he sends back and says, I'm not available before, the clear inference to be made there is that it's not going to happen on the 15th. Now, I think that Judge Bernard and I think all of you have raised the issue of what the standard here is. And it's very clear that under Rule 52 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, when there's a bench trial, the trial court's factual findings cannot be set aside unless clearly erroneous and due regard has to be given to the opportunity the trial court has to assess the credibility of witnesses. And I also want to refer to a statement in Lowry v. Palm, the case is cited in our brief, and I'm looking at page 558. But when evidence is conflicting, a reviewing court may not substitute its own conclusions for those of the trial court just because there may be some credible evidence supporting a different conclusion. That's not the standard here. And the legal standards here aren't really disputed. And performance of a real estate contract occurs at closing. Whether the anticipatory repudiation has occurred is a question of fact. That's under the Johnson v. Benson case. So the trial court had to look at the facts and determine whether there was a definite and unequivocal manifestation on the part of the Harshes that they would not tender a deed on that date. This intent can be established through conduct and statements, and I submit that's what happened here. This is an objective standard. The court has to determine the reasonable interpretation of the statements and conduct. Here, the trial judge determined that the intent of the Harshes not to close on August 15th was unequivocally manifested by the statement of counsel that she could not attend the closing on that date and needed to reschedule, which was communicated accurately by the closing agent to counsel for the district, unequivocally informing him that the closing could not occur on the 15th. And the finding that the Harshes did need their counsel to attend, given the fact that the deed and other documents had not been drafted in advance.
Counsel, I apologize for interrupting, but I would like you to address the argument about the unauthorized, whether the closing agent was authorized to communicate on behalf of the Harshes.
Certainly. The trial court addresses this head on in his order, that he acknowledges that the closing agent is not acting as an agent of either party. However, as the closing agent who has the responsibility to set the time and place of closing, she has a vital role, played a vital role in communications between the parties on how and when this is going to get set. So, and he also determined that the information was, I think as you noted in your questioning of my colleague, that there was no evidence that it was inaccurately conveyed. That the information was inaccurately conveyed. He found that it was accurate. Now, the court's factual findings have ample support in the record and are not clearly erroneous. Ultimately, the Harshes did not present any credible evidence that they were prepared to proceed without their attorney. The trial court found, and I think I've mentioned already, that they would only be prepared to report without their attorney if they had the documents ahead of time, which they did not. There was no requirement that the district prepare these documents. And in fact, the place and time had never been set. Thus, the statement made in the reply brief, and I believe at trial, that but for the district's repudiation, the contract would have closed, has no support in the record. Had there been any credible evidence of that, the judge likely would have reached a different conclusion. On this point, it is important to note again that the trial court did not find Mr. Harsh's testimony regarding his ability to close without his counsel to be credible. Taking into account the trial court's assessment of the credibility of the witnesses, the record supports his findings that while the Harshes may have been willing as a personal matter to proceed on the 15th, and there were no conditions left for them to perform, they had not prepared a deed or other documents, had not gone over them with their attorney, and the place and time for closing had not been set. If they had appeared at the title company on the 15th with a deed, perhaps the outcome of the trial would have been different, but they did not. Ultimately, whether you call it mutual anticipatory repudiation or something else, the trial court reached the correct result in the facts of this case. Were the obligations under the Daybreak construction case cited in our brief, were the obligations of a real estate contractor mutual and concurrent, if one party makes no tender of the deed, the seller, and the buyer makes no tender of the purchase price, neither is in default. Thus, the Harshes can't recover their damages unless they performed. In other words, unless they could establish that but for the district's inability to be there on the 15th, the district would have received tender of a deed from the Harshes on that date. They did not prove that at trial. The trial court concluded that there were simply too many loose ends on both sides, and neither side was genuinely ready to proceed, but for the failures solely attributable to the other party. Despite the fact that it was not there to close on August 15th, and we don't dispute that, the district wanted to close this transaction. It was the Harshes who refused to reschedule. As a result, they retained their property in the same condition they had it before. They should not be entitled to a windfall of $75,000 while keeping their property when they were not prepared to attend the closing with a deed in hand on August 15th, 2008. And unless there are any further questions, I do not need the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Peters, you've got a little over half a minute.
Let me start with, it's clear to me from counsel's arguments as well as the trial court's order, which has a whole paragraph about how inequitable this result is, that the trial court got to the outcome it wanted. I think it did it in a way that the law and the facts did not allow. The trial court clearly saw this as a penalty, even though it used the phrase, I don't think this is a penalty. He went through a whole paragraph examining it like it was. And I think the trial court was looking for a way not to give the Harshes what they're entitled to under this contract. The parties agreed. If one side was at fault for not going to closing, the only remedy for the buyer, for the seller, was the $75,000, earnest money. And we asked this court to enforce that contract as written. Thank you.
Also, thank you very much for your argument.